Welcome to another episode of Connecting the Dots podcast. I'm H.F. Mason. I'm a general surgeon and chief medical officer at Baptist Memorial Hospital DeSoto and chief quality officer for the Baptist system.
And hey, everybody, I'm Jake Lancaster. I'm an internal medicine physician and the chief medical information officer for the Baptist system.
I'm Gemma Jones. I'm based in the UK. I'm an improvement coach and I work with people all across the world. I'm very proud to be a partner with Baptist, working with members of the process improvement team.
Well, guys, we have a treat today. Our guest is Colonel Fulbert, Colonel retired?
It was at one point, but I'm a retired lieutenant colonel now.
Retired Lieutenant Colonel Robert Cujo Teschner. Robert is a graduate of the Air Force Academy. He was an Air Force fighter pilot, flew, I think, F-15s and F-22s, and was a squadron leader. And now he consults with organizations and to help businesses improve. And today we're going to talk about his book called Debrief to Win. And Robert, just before we get started, just tell us a little bit about how you got to where you are today after being in the Air Force.
Brilliant. Thank you very much, first of all, for the opportunity to come join you here on your outstanding podcast. It's wonderful to be in your virtual midst today. My journey to you starts at age 4 when I saw Star Wars and I decided that I wanted to be a fighter pilot. I got a chance to live my dream. Went to the Air Force Academy, graduated, and did well enough in the pilot screening program to go to pilot training, got to pick my airplane coming out of pilot training, became an F-15 pilot, and then eventually got a chance to fly F-22 Raptors. The career was going great right up until I got colorectal cancer. That was a bit of a bummer. It was a good pivot point for us, though, as a family. I'll take a demotion on my retirement. I was a colonel, Dr. Mason, for about 6 months. But I retired early from the Air Force and retired as a lieutenant colonel. And in all of that, all the way back when I was a young captain teaching at the U.S. Air Force Fighter Weapons School, now called the Weapons Instructor Course, I had this suspicion that what we were living as high-performance team members was something that was desperately needed outside of military high-performance teams. And that suspicion was reinforced by stories that I heard from people in industry who were lamenting the absence of leadership and really the breakdown of teamwork at the team level. And so I figured someday down the road, perhaps I would give it a shot and try to teach what I was teaching at the weapons school into the business domain. So cancer was a fantastic pivot point into a new journey. And after having been in two companies that both struggled with the same things that people were telling me about when I was a young captain, I decided to go out on my own, found VMAX Group, my first company there, and then started bringing high-performance team principles and approaches into the outside world. And here we are.
Okay. Well first, I got to clear the air. Was Cujo your call sign? Or
it was, yeah.
I'm a Stephen King fan, and so if our a lot of our listeners out there, that Cujo was a famous book and movie by Stephen King.
That's right, yeah. And so fighter pilot call signs aren't chosen by the pilot themselves; they're awarded by the tribe, and so my call sign ceremony was a very, very, very long and exciting experience where at the end of many, 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 many hours, the team voted and they said that from now on until the day that I die, I'll be known as Cujo. And I lucked out. Cujo is a pretty cool call sign. So I'm happy with that. I prefer it over Robert, by the way.
Well, we will call you Cujo if you want us to for the rest of the podcast.
I love it.
And I want to point out that you're actually, I think, our second fighter pilot to have joined the show. We had John Gucci Foley on probably over 2 years ago. And, you know, to me, it's just amazing how much degree of control and performance you all have in your industry compared to what we're even just striving to get to basics in healthcare. Help me understand, how did it get that way? Like, because, I mean, it didn't start that way from day one with the Wright brothers, but, you know, how did y'all get to be so high performing?
Well, first of all, if you think about it, our industries are very, very similar in so many ways. High reliability, high consequence operations, we cannot afford to fail in the jobs that we do. So there are huge, devastating consequences with the failures that come out of our lines of work. So great question. And Dr. Lancaster, when I wrote Debrief to Win, did some research to try to figure out the origin story to the approach that I've lived my entire military career. What I was really somewhat surprised to find out is that all the teaming approaches we use originate essentially in World War One. So if you think about World War One, difficult time to be a fighter pilot because there's never been fighter pilots before. Like, airplanes are brand new. The whole notion of using an airplane as an instrument of war is brand new. And so it was basically experiential learning, on the job learning while being shot at, which is a really dangerous place to be. One of the things that stunned me about the fighter pilot experience in the First World War was that the average life expectancy was 3 weeks. So, I mean, just think about leading an organization where turnover is driven by death in 3 week increments. That had to have been horrific. And it was also a time of what I call incentivized individualism, meaning you were incentivized to shoot down five enemy aircraft, because if you shot down five enemy aircraft as an individual, then you're going to be declared an ace. An ace status is going to put you on the front page of your local newspaper. You're going to win a nice old medal. You might even earn some extra cash. And just to signify how big of a deal it was in World War One to be a fighter ace, we still remember them today. Like, the Red Baron name is still known in the year 2024. And so that's kind of a big thing. And yet on both sides of the equation, there was an acknowledgement by leadership that we cannot win this with individualists alone. If we're going to win, we got to field a team. And the key thing about the team is that it has to learn. It has to learn from mission to mission. And so what I found in writing Debrief to Win, the Germans were the first to do so. And what they did was, as post-mission, analyze how was it that we ended up with this result. And they factored the theory or hypothesis from that into the planning for an execution of the next mission, and just kept that rhythm going. So accountability ends up being a team learning mechanism that follows a mission. And on the U.S. side, on the Allied side, it was the exact same. What's really important, I think, and relevant for your audience to know, is that the Allied Expeditionary Forces, which then turned into the U.S. Army Air Corps, which in turn birthed the United States Air Force in 1947, we've never stopped doing this. And this model of going into an immediate learning session post-event, regardless of outcome, has served us exceedingly well. And what we've discovered is that we can do this team learning approach that says post-mission, we're always going to learn. We're going to factor what it is that we think we've learned from this into the planning for the next iteration. Just keep on iterating at this. We've become much more human in terms of how we do it. So we've removed, in most cases, any sort of judgment, punitive action, any sort of weaponization or harm from the approach. And it has morphed into an exceedingly human enterprise of always learning, equipping us with the ability to have a high degree of confidence in our ability to have a great mission the next time around. And if we experience some version of failure this time, it's turned into our resilience strategy. So we've got a baked in resilience strategy to help us post failure to be able to bounce back and have a better experience the next time. And in our world, regardless of what it is that we do, that's a great thing to have.
This is so timely because there's a new series. It's on Apple TV. It's called Masters of the Air. And there's only been two episodes out. And during the first one, it's about the 100th bomb group of the 8th Air Force, these B-17 teams. And on one of their first missions, they it's a day mission. They get all shot up with flak. And when they land, everybody's kind of going crazy. And I remember how many times he said, save it for the debrief, save it for the debrief. So I thought that was pretty cool.
That's right. And Masters of the Air is pretty cool, by the way. We had family movie night watching the first two episodes last Friday. Can't wait for episode three today.
That's right. Comes out today.
What I really love, Cujo, is that you really bring it back to the fact that it's about learning, that the debrief is about learning and moving forward and, you know, reflecting and reviewing and seeing what happened, but really taking it forward in a positive way and about learning. I think that's really powerful.
That's right. You think about, you know, what has happened to accountability over the years. And I would say that it's been 100% weaponized. You know, so the term that we typically end up hearing used constantly is we need to hold somebody to account. And embedded in that, is, hey, we failed at something. Accountability follows a failure. Once we failed, somebody's got to be punished for it. And so people typically don't get too fired up about it, and they're very defensive, you know. And so a defensive practice of accountability at the end of the day, at the beginning of the day, all throughout the day, does not serve the good of the team. So how do you overcome that? A couple of things that I would note about the human experience. And I would say, you know, for your listeners, for this podcast, my suspicion is that you know how to deal with the criminal element. You know how to deal with people that are technically incompetent and should not be doing their jobs. So let's take those people out of the discussion for today. Okay. Let's talk about the rest of the folks that are out there. Our assumption in a fighter squadron is that the rest of the folks that are coming to work are trying to get the job done. So we're going to assume, as my friend Les Landis says, we're going to assume positive intent from our teammates. So if we come into this thing assuming positive intent, then that positions us as leaders to go from punishers to mentors and coaches. And in a team accountability session that turns into a learning session, if we can mentor and coach our teammates to be able to bounce back from a failure today and have belief in themselves that they've got what it takes to be able to have a better day tomorrow, that's an antidote to the way that accountability has been practiced for so long and in pretty much every organization. And so what it does is it turns the team dynamic around, and people start to want to admit to where it was that they came up short. And it's in the process of admitting to where it is that we come up short that we identify fixes. And in the process of identify fixes, equip ourselves with the ability to make better decisions the next time. And again, in high reliability, high consequence operations, that's really, really important. And so in the fighter world, I mean, for sure in fighter aviation, but then let's also expand the scope to pockets of high performance teams like Navy SEALs that learn how to do this from Top Gun and your Army Rangers and whatever. We see our ability to learn as a team as our competitive advantage. And so instead of people running from accountability, we run towards it, because we know that we're going to equip ourselves with the ability to have a better mission tomorrow, a better day tomorrow. And who wouldn't want that? So it is our secret weapon that helps us to be able to always have high degree of confidence in our ability to do better tomorrow. And who wouldn't want that?
Absolutely.
I like that you said, I mean, you'll have the debrief, whether or not the mission was a success or a failure. In healthcare, we really only do it if there's an event, if something bad happens, a death or traditional morbidity and mortality conferences, have a bulk of it.
Yeah.
And, we have one we have a review every Friday at noon. We'll review some events, but we never do the successful ones. We never review those. And I don't even know what that would look like in healthcare, to be honest, how you would do it. I mean, how do you review a successful mission? What do you focus on?
So part of it, and great question, by the way, Dr. Lancaster, part of it is we follow the same methodology regardless of outcome. And the methodology that we follow is 180 out from what I see executed in businesses and organizations of all shapes and sizes. The most prevalent form of post-mission analysis, if you will, is, hey team, what went well here and what didn't? And I am 100% against that. And I'm 100% against it because there is no rigor to it, and it also does not embed a root cause with it. And so you can use that to cover things up almost unintentionally and have a false sense of security going into the next iteration that all is well. And so I used to be very measured about this. Now I'm like 100% get rid of those questions. They're the wrong questions. They don't give us the structure necessary to have a high degree of confidence that we actually have learned something, and absent a root cause, we've gained nothing. We've wasted time. So So the structure of a debrief is very, very important. And the debrief structure begins with gathering the facts. And one of the things that I've noticed is that regardless of success or failure, so many people believe that they have exclusive rights to the salient or relevant facts that they just skip to the conclusions. And oftentimes they're wrong. And so it could be, and this is a really important function, that one of the relevant facts on the heels of a supposed victory is that we didn't win due to us. We got lucky. But if we don't unearth that fact in the early part of our analysis, then we can have a false sense of confidence that we're going to win again tomorrow. And that's a bad thing to have. So we have to get to the proximate truth. And the only way to get to the proximate truth is to make sure that everybody has a voice in the fact-gathering phase. And that happens every single time. So long-winded answer to your question is, we're always going to make sure that we're scrutinizing the facts to ensure that we are in agreement on what it was that really took place. And even in the midst of a potential success, we might be shocked to find that we didn't win due to us. So that's an important one. Part of the methodology involves always asking a focus question. And at a minimum, we need to ask the question, why did we or did we not achieve the success that we sought to achieve? You know, so post a successful operation, why did this operation go successfully? And the why question should trigger root cause analysis. And every debrief needs to have substantive root cause analysis conducted so that we're confident that we've arrived at a satisfying substantive answer that can allow us to come up with a substantial way forward, something that we can hang our hats on reliably to say, yeah, I think tomorrow is going to be better than today. So root cause analysis is embedded into every debrief of success and failure. And the way that I would say it is root cause analysis has to be done very humanely. There has to be empathy involved in root cause analysis. We have to understand the context within which people made the decisions that they did and took the actions that they did to award them credit, even when the decisions or actions were poor, for making the best decision that they could in those circumstances. It's not just about fact, why, trigger defensiveness. Let's have a human conversation and give people credit for, assuming positive intent, doing the best they could in the circumstances that they were in, which leads to framing our root cause in a way that's appropriate to the situation. And then the final piece of every debrief is to figure out what's our way forward. So hopefully within that incredibly long-winded answer, Dr. Wingmaster, I've given you some insight into, I don't believe that all of our victories are due to us. And I do believe that we need to find a satisfying root cause to be able to identify who it is that we can celebrate for doing the great work, or why it is that potentially this wasn't as big of a victory as it needed to have been, so that we can build a game plan, have a better day tomorrow. And that's mission critical in healthcare. That's mission critical in fighter aviation. That's mission critical anywhere that you got high reliability, high consequence operations taking place. And the debrief does that.
Now, go ahead, Jenna.
I just wanted to ask a question, because it strikes me from listening to you talk that a lot of this is pinned on the culture of that team to be able to receive that debrief and receive the critique and the root cause in a way that, and you talk about it being humane, and I love that, but it's about that group of people being able to hear that and understand that and receive that. And so I'm interested in your thoughts on how you develop that in an area where that doesn't currently exist, maybe. You know, I guess it's about demonstrating and showing, and you talk about the leader, you know, putting their hand up and admitting their mistakes or where things went wrong. But what else could you tell us about developing that culture?
Great. Okay, so Gemma, let me ask you this. Did you see the movie Top Gun that came out in 1986 starring Tom Cruise and Kelly? All right, what did you think about the culture evidenced in that film?
So it didn't feel like what you're describing. It didn't feel like that psychologically safe. Yeah.
It was 180 out from my experience in a fighter squad.
Wow.
Okay. And that's not to say that it wasn't representative for the time, but what I can tell you is that in a U.S. Air Force fighter squadron today, if you cannot be vulnerable And we define vulnerability, as Dr. Clark says, as exposing oneself to a potential state of loss or harm. I would say it's the capacity and willingness to be honest when it's uncomfortable to be. If you cannot be vulnerable, you cannot take absolute ownership. And what we expect, like one of the non-negotiables in a fighter squad, is that we own everything that happens on our watch. So when the team fails, I own that as a team member, not just as a team leader. And as a team leader, for sure, I own everything that happens amongst all the members of my team, which demands that I'm able to be vulnerable and admit to my own mistakes and weaknesses, talk about the things that I did wrong. So if you can't do that, you're cut from the team. In order to be able to have an environment, though, where people can be vulnerable, we have to have a high degree of psychological safety, which, again, Dr. Timothy Clark, author of The Four Stages of Psychological Safety, says is an environment of rewarded vulnerability. And so it really starts with when people are vulnerable, when they're willing to say, listen, I think I screwed this thing up. I made the bad call at this time to go left and not right. Then instead of attacking them and punishing them and judging them and saying that was the most idiotic move ever in the history of fighter aviation, I cannot believe that you ever made it through the wickets and are sitting here with me today. Instead of that, we got to go, okay, appreciate that. That's a valuable piece of information. And that's really going to help us to unearth how it is that today things didn't go the way that they should have been. So we're going to reward that vulnerability. And then at the end of the whole thing, the idea isn't to attack the person that made the bad call, but rather to equip them with the confidence to know how to make the right call the next time. And in the midst of a failure, to celebrate, we did this right, we did this right, we did this right. Look at this. There was only one thing that went wrong today. It was this decision. Any doubt in our collective minds about our ability to make the right decision tomorrow? No, there's not. Good. Okay, well, then let's go make a better decision tomorrow, team. And what we found is that fear can motivate and inspire a team to do well for a short period of time, but over the long haul, it really doesn't work. Equipping people with the confidence that they've got what it takes by getting to substantive root cause in a fact-based way really helps accelerate learning and builds leaders very, very quickly. And psychological safety is the secret sauce that we have. And by the way, we never talked about that when I was a fighter pilot. I never heard the term psychological safety until I did the research to write Debrief to Win, but it is the secret sauce. And according to Dr. Clark, whose work I'm a big fan of, I'm a big fan of Dr. Timothy Clark and Dr. Amy Edmondson, Novartis Professor of Leadership and Management, Harvard Business School. According to Dr. Clark, an Air Force fighter squadron is one of the highest quotients of psychological safety you're going to find in an organization. Mm. We don't know we have it, but we do. And that's really mission critical. So do the Marines. So does the Navy. So does any pocket of high performance out there.
Yeah, you're describing what we like to call here at Baptist a just culture, you know, where people feel empowered to admit mistakes. But, you know, my question is, you know, we found out and we learned that most of the time, much more than most of the time, it is a process issue or a systems issue rather than a person issue. How does that translate into, you know, a fighter squadron? Do you have the same findings there?
It can be. I mean, because if you think about it this way, our enemies are getting stronger by the day. And so we have to be adaptive. We've got to be innovative. You can't do the same thing every single time because that would make it too easy for whomever else. And so, yeah, so process can be inadequate. Tactics can have to change as a consequence of new innovations on the enemy side of the equation. And so that is a piece of it. The other piece of it, though, is that we do tend to make mistakes. We do not make always the best quality decisions. We don't take the actions that we should have, given the context in which we find ourselves. And so very often it is actually the human in the seat.
A human error, yeah.
That's making an error. The question is, why did that error exist? And a lot of times, due to the complexity of the situation we find ourselves, we've put somebody into a position that they've never been in before, and they're trying to adapt and select from all the different options the right one for this circumstance. And it's easy in retrospect of what we say would be at 1G, So just like right now, we're sitting around just kind of thinking, to be able to come back in off the top rope and say, you know, that was an idiot move. How dare you? But we're going to give people credit for being in the circumstances that they were in, for making the best quality decision that they were equipped to make, given their experience level, given what was happening at the time, and realizing that they were trying their best. And so we will have conversations about the person, not the process, in a way that helps inspire the person to be able to rise to the occasion the next time that they find themselves in a similarly complex situation. And we're not going to hold them to the standard of perfection, which is too easy to do. It's very easy as human beings to rush to judgment and to apply an unfair standard of you've got to be perfect always. That's impossible. So we're very conscientious about that. And we recognize the need to understand the complexity within which we operate. And that's a topic for an entirely different podcast episode, if we want to overlay complexity and into this equation.
Well, you know, I might be the only one that's a little disappointed that real life is not like Top Gun with the flybys and you know, and being dangerous and that being okay. But no, no, in reality, yeah, that makes much more sense. And certainly I wouldn't want a rogue surgeon out there like a Jeff doing his operations up. But, you know, that's my question is for the debriefs. A lot of times in healthcare, our teams change every time we do a new case. I work with a different nurse this time or different physical therapist. You know, HF, you may be with a different scrub tech. I don't know. I don't know how it is for the surgeons. I never want to be in the OR. But how can debriefs work if our team keeps changing constantly?
Good. I would say that my team changed every time that I flew. I mean, I very rarely flew with the same four ship every time that I stepped out the door. You know, we've got a cadre of pilots to choose from based upon who's available on the schedule that day. We shift who leads. We shift what position we're in. We shift the teams constantly. So that's very representative of a fighter squadron.
Okay.
What protects us here is the rigor of the approach. The debrief discipline remains the same. So no mission is done until we've debriefed it. And the structure that we follow in the debrief is the same every single time. Now, I go back to what went well and what didn't. One of the great poisons of that approach is that especially when the teams are changing all the time, it becomes even more easy to harness those questions in a way that's self-protecting, which again masks the fact that we haven't unearthed the root cause. We haven't gotten to a substantive answer to those questions and actually masks the fact that we're carrying unnecessary risk forward. So because of the changing team structure, I'm going to put another plug in for follow the discipline and the rigor of the debrief, because that's going to protect you and make sure that we are getting satisfying outcomes from these analyses. Be nothing worse than spending an hour in a debrief that unearths nothing useful. And we've unfortunately managed to carry risk forward. And as a frequent customer of the healthcare space, I have actually a high degree of self-interest in this being done correctly. Yes.
You know, I'm thinking about areas in healthcare that may be similar. You know, for instance, you know, daily huddles or shift huddles. I guess that could be, you know, most of the floors, the med-surg floors and the units, they'll have a little huddle first thing in the morning, and then they'll have a, you know, for the morning shift or day shift, and then they'll have a huddle in the evening. I suppose that would be an area where, you know, it's sort of like a debrief, I guess, but I guess you do have to ask those questions. What, you know, how did we do today?
So the great point, like, you know, what defines a debrief? Yeah. And throughout the course of my time teaching this, I've heard a lot of things that sort of could be almost worse in a general sense, maybe, but actually aren't debriefs. And yet we kind of give ourselves credit for doing them. So I'm 100% in lockstep with you on those huddles could incorporate a debrief. But what is a debrief? It's the constructive evaluation of the quality of our decisions and associated actions measured against the objectives we set out to achieve. So it's got to follow that rigor. We got to evaluate constructively. We've got to check decision and action quality against the objectives that we set. And that warrants that we've actually planned to win. So we have to set the accountability baseline at some point against which we're going to measure. If we were to sit here right now and debrief, how did this podcast go? I would come back and say, measured against what standard? Like, we actually right now don't have the right to debrief this sucker. Okay. So to try to do so would be technically incorrect.
Well, just to get a little, you know, Air Force Navy competition, you're going to have to try to beat Gucci in the downloads. That's going to be the nature of the success.
Okay. Okay, good. All right. I'll do my best.
Well, Pujo, man, this has been, it's been great. And unfortunately, we're going to have to kind of wrap it up. And, you know, we, you know, I think it'd be a great idea to have you back on talking about complexity. You know, as Stuart, Skip likes to say, is that, you know, healthcare is one of the most complex socio-technical systems out there. And I mean, just an amazing amount of complexity. And I think I see another podcast, Skip. But Cujo, on behalf of Baptist Memorial Healthcare, thank you so much for being with us. Gemma, thank you so much for being with us from across the pond, and we always enjoy being with you. But guys, you know, this podcast, CME is available, and you can see on the show notes wherever you listen to your podcast on how to redeem those. And once again, Cujo, thank you very much.
My sincere pleasure. Thank you so much for having me. Keep on winning out there.